Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 98 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descendant life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much all of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd because, on the whole, it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, and even the ones with digital watches were miserable. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place. And some said that even the trees had been a bad move, and that no one should ever have left the oceans. And then, one Thursday, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rickmansworth suddenly realized what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could make a good and happy place. And this time it was right, it would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone about it, a terrible, stupid catastrophe occurred, and the idea was lost forever. This is not her story, but it is the story of that terrible, stupid catastrophe and some of its consequences. It is also the story of a book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Not an Earth book, never published on Earth, and until the terrible catastrophe occurred, never seen or even heard of by any Earthman. Nevertheless, a wholly remarkable book. In fact, it was probably the most remarkable book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor, of which no Earthman had ever heard either. Not only is it a wholly remarkable book, it is also a highly successful one, more popular than the Celestial Home Care Omnibus, better selling than 53 More Things to Do in Zero Gravity, and more controversial than Olin Kolofit's trilogy of philosophical blockbusters, Where God Went Wrong, Some More of God's Greatest Mistakes, and Who Is This God Person Anyway? In many of the more relaxed civilizations on the outer eastern rim of the galaxy, The Hitchhiker's Guide has already supplanted the Great Encyclopedia Galactica as the standard repository of all knowledge and wisdom, for though it has many omissions and contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, it scores over the older, more pedestrian work in two important respects. First, it is slightly cheaper, and second, it has the words "Don't Panic" inscribed in large, friendly letters on its cover. But the story of this terrible, stupid Thursday, the story of its extraordinary consequences, and the story of how these consequences are inextricably intertwined with its remarkable book begins very simply. It begins with a house. Chapter 1. The house stood on a slight rise, just on the edge of the village. It stood on its own and looked out over a broad spread of West Country farmland. Not a remarkable house by any means. It was about 30 years old, squattish, squarish, made of brick, and had four windows set in the front of a size of in the front of size and proportion, which more or less exactly failed to please the eye. The only person for whom the house was any way special was Arthur Dent, and that was only because it happened to be the one he lived in. He had lived in it for about 3 years, ever since he had moved out of London because it made him nervous and irritable. It was about 30 as well, tall, dark-haired, and never quite at ease with himself. The thing that used to worry him most was the fact that people always used to ask him what he was looking so worried about. He worked in local radio, which he always used to tell his friends was a lot more interesting than they probably thought. It was, too, most of his friends worked in advertising. On Wednesday night, it had rained very heavily. The lane was wet and muddy, But the Thursday morning sun was bright and clear as it shone on Arthur Dent's house, for it was to be the last time. It hadn't properly registered yet with Arthur that the council wanted to knock it down and build a bypass instead. At 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, Arthur didn't feel very good. He woke up blearily, got up, wandered blearily around his room and opened a window, saw a bulldozer, found his slippers, and stomped off to the bathroom to wash. Toothpaste on the brush, soap, scrub. Shaving mirror, pointing at the ceiling. He adjusted it. For a moment, it reflected a second bulldozer through the bathroom window. Properly adjusted, it reflected Arthur Dent's bristles. He shaved them off, washed, dried, and stomped off to the kitchen to find something pleasant to put in his mouth. Kettle, plug, fridge, milk, coffee. Yawn. The word bulldozer wandered through his mind for a moment in search of something to connect with. The bulldozer outside the kitchen window was quite a big one. He stared at it. Yellow, he thought, and stomped off back to his bedroom to get dressed. Passing the bedroom, he stopped to drink a large glass of water, and then another. He began to suspect he was hungover. Why was he hungover? Had he been drinking the night before? He supposed he must have been. He caught a glint in the shaving mirror. Yellow, he thought, and stomped off to the bedroom. He stood and thought. The pub, he thought. Oh dear, the pub. He vaguely remembered being angry. Angry about something that had, seemed important. He'd been telling people about it, yes. Telling people about it at great length. He rather suspected his clearest visual recollection was of glazed looks on other people's faces. Something about a new bypass he'd just found out about. It had been in the pipeline for months, only no one seemed to have known about it. Ridiculous. He took a swig of water. It went sort of itself out. He decided no one wanted a bypass. The council didn't have a leg to stand on. It would sort itself out. God, what a terrible hangover he had earned him. He looked at himself in the wardrobe mirror. He stuck out his tongue. Yellow, he thought. The word yellow wandered through his mind in search of something to connect with. 15 seconds later, he was out of the house and lying in front of a big yellow bulldozer that was advancing up his garden path. Mr. L. Prosser was, as they say, only human. In other words, he was a carbon-based bipedal life form descended from an ape. More specifically, he was 40, fat, and shabby, and worked for the local council. Curiously enough, though, he didn't know it. He was also a direct male-line descendant of Genghis Khan, though intervening generalizations and racial mixing had so juggled his genes that he had no discernible Mongoloid characteristics, and the only vestiges left in Mr. L. Prosser of his mighty ancestry were a pronounced stoutness of the tum and a predilection for large fur hats. He was by no means a great warrior. In fact, he was a nervous, worried man. Today, he was worried, particularly nervous, and he worried because something had gone seriously wrong with his job, which was to see that Arthur Dent's house got cleared out of the way before the day was out. "Come off it, Mr. Dent," he said. "You can't win, you know. You can't lie in front of the bulldozer indefinitely." He tried to make his eyes blaze furiously, and they just wouldn't do it. Arthur lay in the mud and squelched at him. "I'm game," he said. "We'll see you rusts first." "I'm afraid you're going to have to accept it," said Mr. Prosser, gripping his fur hat and rolling it around the top of his head. "This bypass has got to be built, and it's going to be built." "First I've heard of it," said Arthur. "Why's it got to be built?" Mr. Prosser shook his finger at him for a bit, and then stopped, and put away again. "What do you mean, why's it got to be built?" he said. "It's a bypass. You've got to build bypasses." "And bypasses are devices that allow some people to dash from point A to point B very fast, while other people dash from point B to point A very fast. People living at point C, being a point directly in between, are often given to wonder what's so great about point A that so many people from point B are so keen to get there, and what's so great about point B that so many people from point A are so keen to get there. They often wish that people would just once and for all work out where the hell they wanted to be." Mr. Prosser wanted to be at point D. Point D wasn't anywhere in particular. It was just convenient point of B, you know. Very long way from points A and B and C. He wouldn't have a nice little cottage at point D, with axes over the door, and spend a pleasant amount of time at point E, which he would be nearest to pup. He would be the nearest pup to point D. His wife, of course, wanted climbing roses, but he wanted axes. He didn't know why, he just liked axes. He flushed hotly under the derisive glint of the bulldozer drivers. He shifted his weight from foot to foot, but it was equally uncomfortable in each. And obviously, somebody had appallingly incompetent, he hoped to God wasn't him. Mr. Prosser said, "You were quite entitled to make any suggestions or protests at the appropriate time, you know." "Appropriate time?" hooted Arthur. "Appropriate time? The first I knew about it was when a workman arrived at my home yesterday. I asked him if he'd come to clean the windows, and he said he'd come to demolish the house. He didn't tell me straight away, of course. Oh, no. First he wiped a couple of windows and charged me a fiver. Then he told me. But Mr. Dent, the plans have been available in the local planning office for nearly 9 months. Oh, yes, well, as soon as I heard, I went straight round to see them yesterday afternoon. You hadn't exactly gone out of your way to call attention to them, had you? I mean, like, actually telling anybody or anything. But the plans were on display. On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar to find them. That's the display department. With a flashlight. Oh, well. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs. But look, you found the notice, didn't you? Yes, said Arthur. Yes, I did. It was on display in the bottom of a locked filing cabinet stuck in a disused lavatory with a sign on the door saying, "Beware of the leopard." A cloud passed overhead and it cast a shadow over Arthur Dent as he lay propped up on his elbow in the cold mud. It cast a shadow over Arthur Dent's house. Mr. Prosser frowned at it. "It's not as if it's a particularly nice house," he said. "I'm sorry, I happen to like it." "You'll like the bypass." "Oh, shut up," said Arthur Dent. "Shut up and go away, and take your bloody bypass with you. You haven't got a leg to stand on, and you know it." Mr. Prosser's mouth opened and closed a couple of times while his mind was, for a moment, filled with inexplicable but terribly attractive visions of Arthur Dent's house being consumed with fire. And Arthur himself running screaming from the blazing ruin with at least 3 hefty spears protruding from his back. Mr. Prosser was often bothered with visions like these, and they made him feel very nervous. He stuttered for a moment and then pulled himself together. "Mr. Dent," he said. "Hello, yes," said Arthur. "Some factual information for you. Have you any idea how much damage that bulldozer could suffer if it just were to roll right over you?" "How much?" said Arthur. "Well, none at all," said Mr. Prosser, and stormed nervously off, wondering why his brain was full of 1,000 hairy horsemen all shouting at him. By a curious coincidence, "none at all" is exactly how much suspicion the ape descendant, Arthur Dent, had, that one of his closest friends was not descended from an ape, but was in fact from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of a Betelgeuse, and not from Guilford, as he usually claimed. Arthur Dent had never, ever suspected this. This friend of his had arrived on the planet Earth some 15 years earlier, and had worked hard to blend himself into Earth society with, it must be said, some success. For instance, he had spent those 15 years pretending to be an out-of-work actor, which was plausible enough. He had made one careless blunder, though. Because he had skimped a bit on his preparatory research, the information he had gathered had led him to choose the man Ford Prefect as being nicely inconspicuous. He was not conspicuously tall. His features were striking, but not conspicuously handsome. His hair was wiry and gingerish and brushed backward from his temples. His skin seemed to be pulled backward from the nose. There was something slightly odd about him, though, but it was difficult to say what it was. Perhaps it was that his eyes didn't seem to blink enough when he was talking. For any length of time, your eyes begin involuntarily to water on his behalf. Perhaps it was that he smiled slightly too broadly and gave people the unnerving impression that he was about to go for their neck. He struck most of his friends he had made on Earth as an eccentric but harmless one, an unruly boozer with some oddish habits. For instance, he would often gatecrash university parties, get badly drunk, and start making fun of any astrophysicists he could find till he got thrown out. Sometimes he would get seized with oddly distracted moods and stare into the sky as if hypnotized until someone asked him what he was doing. Then he would start guiltily for a moment, relax, and grin. "Oh, just looking for flying saucers," he would joke, and everyone would laugh at him and and ask him what sort of flying saucers he was looking for. "Green ones," he would reply with a wicked grin, laugh wildly for a moment, and then suddenly lunge for the nearest bar and buy an enormous round of drinks. Evenings like this usually ended badly. Ford would get out of his skull on whiskey, huddle in a corner with some girl, and explain to her in slurred phrases that honestly the color of the flying saucers didn't matter that much, really. Thereafter, staggering, semi-paralytic, down the night streets, he would often ask passing policemen if they knew the way to Betelgeuse. The policeman would usually say something like, "Don't you think it's about time you went home, sir?" "I'm trying to, baby, I'm trying to," is what Ford invariably replied to these on these occasions. In fact, what he was really looking for when he stared directly, distractedly into the sky was any kind of flying saucer at all. The reason he said green was that green was the traditional space livery of the Betelgeuse trading scouts. Ford Prefect was desperate that any flying saucer at all would arrive soon, because 15 years is a long time to get stranded anywhere, particularly somewhere as mind-bogglingly dull as the Earth. Ford wished that a flying saucer would arrive soon, because he knew that to flag flying saucers down and get lifts from them, he knew how to see the marvels of the universe for far less than 30 Ontarian dollars a day. In fact, Ford Prefect was a roving researcher for that wholly remarkable book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.